The story of the UEFA European Championships on OTB Sports with Heineken, official beer partner of UEFA Euro 2020. Finally together to be rivals again. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.
Yes, you're very welcome along. So this is our UEFA European Championships roadshow on OTB Sports with Heineken, official beer partner of UEFA Euro 2020. Finally together to be rivals again. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie. We've got a great show lined up for you. Two brilliant guests. Later on, we're going to chat to the one and only Ali McCoist. First up, though, this is about the Euros and Euros memories. So we have the perfect guest. He can tell us a lot about maybe the greatest Euro story of all time. A tournament winner in 1992. An amazing club career as well with Bayern Munich, AC Milan, Rangers, Chelsea, Ajax, and more besides. I am, of course, talking about the brilliant, the wonderful Prince of Denmark himself, Brian Laudrup. Brian, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So listen, I'm really excited to chat to you all things Euros. Later on, when Ali McCoist joins us, your old teammate, we'll talk a bit about the tournament and a little bit about England-Denmark, I'm sure, and a certain penalty decision you might not be happy with. But for this section, let's talk about you, and in particular, Euro 92 and the story of Euro 92, because it is extraordinary. Just one point on your footballing family. We all know about your brother, Michael. I hadn't realised that your father was such a great player as well. So presumably for young Brian coming through, there's father Finn and there's Michael. There's nowhere for you to hide, really. Everybody's watching what you're about. How was that?
It was difficult, but do not forget my mom. She was a handballer and she was very good as well. So it was very much a sporting family. But having said that, obviously, I mean, being a son of my father, who was a very gifted player in his day, in the 60s into the 70s, he played in Vienna abroad and for the Danish national team as well. And then we all know my brother came along and what a career he has. So I had to go through some difficult moments being compared to two fantastic footballers in your own family. Sometimes you have to say, okay, I have to do it my way or no way at all. And that's what I did. And I have enjoyed every minute of it.
To have one child in the family to be such a brilliant footballer is extraordinary. To have two is almost a minor miracle. So how was it that the Laudrup boys became so good? Were they skipping school and going to training with dad? Were you playing football nonstop? How did this happen?
I think it's all about inspiration, I think. We used to watch our father play, and he was such an inspiration, very technical, a very gifted number 10, playmaker style, and he was a joy to watch. And I think that's the best way to describe it, that he was our inspiration, because obviously we would play, you know, in the streets and in the garden and stuff like that. At times, I felt it was a wee bit difficult. My brother was 5 years older than me. That's not the best way to be introduced into football, because he was so good. But having said that, I think the secret behind that we actually became footballers was that our parents never ever put any pressure on us. I think they wanted us to enjoy ourselves. Whether that would be in football or in another occupation, that was not the important issue here. And I think without pressure, we could develop, we could enjoy the game as it should be. And I think that's the secret behind us becoming footballers.
Okay. Brian, for us to understand 1992, we might just get a word from you on Danish football in the 1980s. So, you know, we're very jealous here because we've a similar population and we've done okay at times, but what Denmark has done is just extraordinary. So Danish football turned professional in the late 1970s, and even then it was slow to become fully professional. But in the 1980s, there is this brilliant Danish team. They go to the semi-finals of Euro 84. They wow people. In particular, there's a 6-1 win at the 86 World Cup against Uruguay. Your brother scores a phenomenal goal. And there's just a real affection, I think, for Danish football around the world. It's exciting. You play flamboyant football. The coach is Sepp Piontek. So he's the manager from 79 to 90. So Danish football across the 1980s really caught the imagination and played a great style of football.
It was all about, I think, the golden generation of the 80s. And as you mentioned, I mean, before that, we never really qualify for anything. So it was more or less a bad joke that when you went back and played for Denmark, it was all about just having some fun, but never really putting any pressure into it, not really expecting Denmark to qualify. And I think that changed when Sepp Piontek entered the frame, because Sepp Piontek, a German, who was, you know, for him, the most important thing was to win and obviously play some attractive football as well, but you needed professionalism. And he introduced that to the players, and I think that was a wake-up call. And he changed everything. So a lot of what is happening now, I think, is a credit to Sepp Piontek, because he changed our mentality. He changed, I think, the self-belief that we could play at the very highest level. And I have to say that the 84-86 Danish Dynamite group of players were absolutely phenomenal. They played, you know, at the very highest level in Europe, whether it was in England or in Italy, Spain. We had some terrific players. And they, I think what they did was we had so many fans from all over the world, because they could actually see, and they mentioned the Danes as, you know, the Scandinavian Brazilians, because we wanted to play some offensive attacking football with a smile on our face. And I think that changed the whole idea and perception of Denmark as just, you know, a country that couldn't really do it at the highest level. And from that moment, I think we saw that in a small country like Denmark, if we can go all the way in 84, 86, do so well, we could do that later on, perhaps in the 90s and further on. Yeah. And that changed the whole scenario.
Where this story gets really interesting, I suppose, is 1990. Euro 88 hasn't gone well, 0 points in 88. 1990 hasn't gone well, obviously. And then there's a change of coach, Richard Møller Nielsen. And this is where things get so interesting. So Richard Møller Nielsen had been under 21's boss in the early 80s. I'm sure you came across him then. And he was the assistant with the senior team between 87 and 90. Now, he's not offered the job initially. The Danish FA, not their finest hour, offered it to someone else. Someone else turns out to be under contract. And eventually they turn around to Møller Nielsen and say, over to you. What was your perspective then of Møller Nielsen? He would have been the assistant. Was he very much seen as the assistant? Did he feel like second choice? Was he greeted with a little bit of disappointment maybe across Denmark when he came in as coach?
That's exactly what happened. I think back then, an assistant, you didn't get perhaps the respect you needed to actually become a manager. And I think that was the problem, that Richard Møller Nielsen wasn't seen as the first choice. He was a very good assistant, but no more than that. But I have to tell you that the guy they actually, you know, offered the manager role to was my manager in Bayer Ulling, Horst Wohlers. And when he went to Denmark, you know, had a conversation about getting the job, they presented him at a press conference, and he was, as you say, under contract. So that died immediately. And then, you know, people turned against the Danish FA, and they had to react quickly and offer the role to Richard Møller Nielsen. So it was a very difficult moment in Danish football history, I have to say that. Well, oh my, he turned favour and produced some incredible moments for Danish football.
Yeah, he sure did. Trust me, Brian, the Irish FA have lots of very bad hours as well, so you're not in your own there. So Møller Nielsen comes in. His job is to get Denmark to Euro 92. Three matches into qualifying, beat the Faroes, draw in Northern Ireland, lose at home to Yugoslavia. Very good Yugoslavian slide. They've reached the World Cup quarterfinal in 1990, but it's a bad start to qualifying. And then November 1990, worldwide headlines. The Laudrup brothers gone, Jan Molby gone, Jan Heinze gone. There is a departure. So you didn't like the tactics, is that correct? Take us inside here. What was it about Møller Nielsen at that stage, across those early stages, that you and Michael said, this isn't for us? Because I hasten to add, you're just 21 years of age. Michael's just 26. It's not like you're a pair of 30-year-olds saying, we'll check out a bit early. This is unbelievable, sensational story. So, Müller-Nielsen, those first three games, talk to us, because I think this is what a lot of people might be interested in.
I think what happened back then was that when Richard Müller-Nielsen took over, he changed the outset. I think he changed the tactics. He was very much a very precautious type of manager. He for him, it was all about defense. And if you've got a good defense, then obviously you could get results. So in terms of what had been in before with Sepp Piontek, which was all about what Denmark did, not about the opponent. And I think that changed a lot in the way the players thought about you playing for Denmark back then. And I have to say, there were some misunderstandings, and that's why I returned to the national team again. But back then, you had the feeling that it was very difficult for Richard Müller-Nielsen to handle players of a certain, a certain type. I was a very attack-minded player. My brother, the same. We had Jan Molby, and he had difficulties actually finding place for all of us in the starting 11. And I think that was a shame because a small country like Denmark, you have to play your best players. I just had the idea and the feeling that he wasn't too fond of the type of player I was. And I thought my brother back then, he was playing for Barcelona, another type of a completely different type of football. And I think for me, it was all about if you're not liked, then I'll better leave the place. And for my brother, he speaks for himself, but I think he wanted to concentrate on his Barcelona career.
Brian, what was the reaction to that decision in Denmark? I would have thought you would not be the most popular boys with a decision like that. Were you seen as almost traitors?
Yeah, very much so. And I have to say that was a learning process for me as well. There were a lot of criticism towards our family, and some was justified, some wasn't. But that's the way football is, and I think you have to say that you have to go through times like that to realize, to become a grown up, to learn from what you the choices you make. And as I say, eventually we sat down, had a long talk about what had happened, some of the things I said, some of the things he said. And we came to a conclusion that let's forget about all that. Let's move forward, look forward to the future. He wanted me back in the national team. I wanted to play for him. And we never looked back.
Yeah, good job too, I would have said. And around the time you did all withdraw, did your father or did anybody around you say, look, fellas, I understand he's not the perfect manager for your style of play, and I'm sure it's a bit miserable if he's asking you to track back and to be disciplined and not to express yourself. I get all that. However, you can't walk away from your country. Don't do this. So, it takes, even if you're young, it's a pretty headstrong decision. Like, you Loudrup boys are a bit stubborn as well then. Did anyone try and talk you around?
We're a bit stubborn. I think... I have to be honest and say that it wasn't, and people might think that that's not true, but it was not a decision that we took together. You know, it was something I said to my brother. I said I can't really keep on playing in an environment like this, and he made his decision. But having said that, it looked like it was like two very stubborn brothers. Because perhaps we weren't loved, you know, then we had to go somewhere else and get that love. But I think, to be honest, sometimes you have to react. Sometimes you have to make a decision, whether it's popular or unpopular. Yes. You have to stick with it. And that was exactly what I did.
And Brian, for you, a last one on this, and then we get into Euro 92. For you, was it more about the tactics and what he was asking you to do on the pitch, or was it more about how he was making you feel in the environment when you said you weren't so sure if he liked you?
I have to say that in hindsight, I could see that he hadn't... I mean, he didn't have anything against me as a person. whatsoever. Okay. But definitely in terms of tactics, I feel that. Okay. And sometimes, as I say again, then you react sometimes too quickly, too impulsive. And I have to say, perhaps at times when I was very young, I did some impulsive things and didn't really think about what would happen in the future. But thank God, yeah, we found out, and it was a decision that to come back and play for the Danish national team, the best decision I've ever made. Not only because of 92 or you know, playing at a World Cup and stuff like that, but it was more about sitting down with a manager, with a person, speak about misunderstandings, and forget about that and move on. And I think for both of us, that was perfect.
Okay. And as part of the reconciliation, did you just have to accept it was his way? Did you suddenly have to work a bit harder and do more defensive duties, or did he give you a little bit more latitude?
I think he gave me a little bit more latitude, but it goes both ways, doesn't it? I think it's all about you have to show that you want to be there. If it takes you, if you have to do a little bit of, you know, defensive work, I was not brilliant at that, I have to say, but I did my best.
Okay.
And he realized where I was at my best. And I think in that respect, we found each other.
So the story is well known and famous enough. After you and the others depart, Denmark win their next five games, but it's not enough to make the Euros. Yugoslavia go through, and then, of course, the war breaks out there, and 11 days out from the tournament, it's decided that they won't be competing. Denmark are in. Now, I think at this stage, Møller-Nielsen is redoing his kitchen, and the players are, I presume, thinking that they're off for the summer. You were at an interesting point. So the reconciliation conversation has happened, I suppose, and you're at Munich thinking about trying to come back from a very, very serious knee injury. I think you arrive home and your wife says there's been an interesting phone call.
That was exactly what happened. Because I was recovering from a cruciate knee ligament damage, and that takes time. I had played a few games in the Bundesliga, but I was out for about 4 or 5 months, and it takes you 4 or 5 months to get back to your old best. And so I stayed behind. The other players were already in holiday. Stayed behind, do some training exercises and sessions and some friendly games. And I came back from one of these friendly games, and my wife says, "I've just been called up by the Danish FA. You have to report tomorrow." And I was like, what? I mean, I'm not prepared for this.
Yeah.
This is going to be people will laugh at us, you know, because we are not prepared for this. Some of the players were already in holiday, which has been described, throughout the years in various media. I was getting back to some sort of level that, you know, would enable me to play for 90 minutes, but not at my best, no way. And I said, I can't go. I'm not prepared for that. I'm not ready. So my wife says, what? I mean, you get an opportunity of your life. We're talking about playing a European championship. You never know when that will happen again. So I sat down for a few minutes and said, you're absolutely right. And I phoned up Flemming Poulsen, who he played, I think, at Dortmund back then. And he was just, you know, coming off the beach somewhere in Greece or somewhere. And we just laughed and said, we're going to the Euro 92. I mean, this is like getting a Christmas present, you know, during a summer holiday. It was absolutely incredible, because we've never experienced it. I mean, we've never been to a Euros or a World Cup before. And I think for us to get that opportunity, despite, and we have to say, the tragic circumstances about the Yugoslavian civil war, we felt that in respect for them, and obviously in respect and try and show the world that we can play football in Denmark, we went to Sweden. And I have to correct you, we had 7 days to prepare for the England game. So it was not ideal. I have to say it was far from ideal.
Yeah.
But yeah, incredible.
What were your personal expectations? I know Møller-Nielsen gathered the players around 7 days out as opposed to 11 now and said, we're going to go to Sweden and we're going to win the competition, and that's all very well. But you personally, after 0 points in Euro 88, what was your ambition for Euro 92, given the short notice?
Not embarrass myself. I think it was whether I would be able to play one game, 90 minutes, or two games, or perhaps less than that, I wasn't sure, because I didn't know where I was in terms of my performances, in terms of you know, how well I would cope with games within the space of, let's say, 6 or 9 days. So that was the tough part of it. But
And for the team, Brian, what did you think was a realistic expectation for the team?
I think what changed the the perception of going to the Euro 92 was that when we met up at the very first training session in Denmark, we gathered on the training pitch, and we stood in a circle, and Richard Mullinson, he was standing in the middle, and he was talking for 5-10 minutes, and all he did was to just tell us that we are actually going there not to make numbers up, but to go there to win. And it was something which, at that point, I looked around, and some people were trying to hide, you know, they were laughing. They were like, what is he on about? Yeah. What has he had for breakfast, you know? Yeah. But what he did, and it was genius, because for me, it was all about telling us we are going there because we have to compete. And we have to show that we are ready. And whether we've got 7 days to prepare, that's fine. But with unity, and unity is something which is stronger than anything in football. We've seen that in these Euro 2020 as well. Mm. That if you're a unity, and if you this togetherness, and you like each other, and you want to, and being underdogs, that's a huge force as well. Mm. If you can bring all that together, you can make a surprise.
So for the purpose of time, we can't go through every game, obviously. You start off against England, nil-all draw in Malbo, play very well. And then it's Sweden, the tournament hosts, lose 1-0. So at that point, realistically, it's not looking good, because you have to get a result against France, the pre-tournament favourites, and you need other results to go your way. Now, this French team, this is Laurent Blanc, this is Cantona, this is Petit, this is Papin, this is Deschamps, and probably many more besides. It's a great generation. Can I read you a quote from Peter Schmeichel? He was talking to the BBC, and he was remembering the game against France, and he said that we had John Sivbach, who played in France at the time, and the French players came up to him beforehand and said, don't be too tough or roughing us today, don't be rough, we've got to play the semi-final. And John Sivbach went and told some of the players, and, well, you can imagine what Peter Schmeichel said about this. So it seems like the French thought, OK, Danes, it's been fun and everything, but it's time to leave. Do you remember that? Were you one of the players that had heard the French saying that to Sivbach before the game, or did you just hear about that afterwards?
I heard about it, and John Sivbach told every single one of us about that. And I think if we weren't prepared for this game, we certainly was from that moment on, because... And when we stood, you know, just before the game, before we went on, we were standing in a line, and these, you know, the French players, they looked at us as, you know, it's going to be easy. And that's something, I think, which you shouldn't do against a Danish team, because then we are fired up. I mean, we used to be underdogs. We are not used to, you know, being favorites, winning titles and stuff like that. But there's something which is a huge force in Denmark and smaller countries, I think. It's the one-off game. And the one-off games are fantastic, because you get to have the best team in the world, but in a one-off game, you've always got a chance. That's why we love cups. You know, competitions and finals and stuff like that. And that was exactly what happened. We got the early goal, which again unsettled the French. They started to, being angry at each other. And you could sense that, they knew that they were in trouble. And that's where we, and that was the perhaps the secret of this Danish team as well, that we had played together for a number of years. You mentioned Brøndby early on, a unique team in Danish football history, the first team to become full professionals in Denmark back in, I think it was 85, 86. Mm. I was among that team as well. So we, and that's the story perhaps which hasn't been told, that, that we were a team of players that had been playing together for a number of years.
Yes.
And we knew each other's strengths and weaknesses in and out.
I hadn't fully appreciated that Brøndby link until doing some research. 10 of the Euro 92 squad were of Brøndby origin. So in some ways, you were like a club team. And you mentioned unity. So you beat the French. It's the Dutch in the semi-final. Oh, my God, the Dutch. But in terms of the atmosphere in the squad around that time, we read things like you're off playing mini golf together. There are trips to McDonald's. I think the wives and girlfriends, because there was no hotel booked for them, were staying with the players. So it seems like there was a fun atmosphere. I don't know, was Møller-Nielsen doing this by design, or just the players were saying, well, this is how we're doing things, or why it happened. But is that all true? The trips to McDonald's, the mini golf, the almost the sense of, well, let's enjoy it as well. Was that a big part of the experience for you?
I think it was. I think it... I think for Richard Møller-Nielsen, it was all about using the underdog role to a maximum effect. I think that was the case, because we were called up so late and we weren't really prepared physically or mentally for a competition like this. And I think to make it, we Danes love to be relaxed, you know, okay, laid back and enjoy ourselves. And I think that's very important. If you change that mentality, then we are not known as typical championship players, like, you know, good for, you know, a Euro or a World Cup can last for 4 or 5 weeks at times. And perhaps we're not as good as that as the Germans or Italians or the big countries. But by doing that, going to, it was only one trip to McDonald's, but okay, one trip, it was fantastic.
I thought it was every day.
But having said that, and I have to say, two or three of the players, when it was mentioned that we could go to McDonald's, they just, you know, argued about if that was a professional attitude, sure, whether that was the way to go forward. But for most of us, it was a fantastic day, and that made us, you know, realize that you can have fun, you can be away in at a Euro 92, enjoy yourself, and produce the goods as well. Because at the end of the day, it's all about the football. But again, you, as a group, you have to unite. You have to have some fun. If it's too serious, then I think the Danes, they start to you know, get a little bit bored. And that was certainly not the case in Sweden in 92.
Yeah, sounds amazing. So you have the Euro 88 champions in the semi-final, the Dutch. It's in Gothenburg. Again, this is Van Basten, this is Hullet, this is Koeman, this is Rijkaard, this is Bergkamp. The list goes on. It's a bit like the French team, only maybe worse again. This goes to penalties. They score a late goal to take it to penalties. You're enduring the agony because of your fitness of having to watch the penalty shootout. And up steps Peter Schmeichel, of course. You got Schmeichel, you got a chance in a penalty shootout, I would think. Overall, the whole day from the game through to the penalties, what's your big memory of the semi-final, or is there a story about the semi-final?
Well, there's a story in particular. I wouldn't say that, but I would certainly say that from all the players in the Danish dressing room, it was all about enjoying the moment. I think it was something we hadn't realized that we could do. It was certainly not something we, even when Richard Møller-Nielsen said that we are going across to Sweden to win it, it was something we didn't really believe in. And I think, but the performances, we grew as a group. We grew in stature. We grew in, I mean, if you could say that we went to Sweden as boys and left as you know, grown-ups, as men. Mm. And that's dramatic, but I think in some respect it's true, because we really showed the world that, you know, you can come in as an underdog, perhaps not even having qualified, and play against the best teams in Europe at that time. We're talking about some of the best teams as you mentioned, the Dutch, they were reigning European champions, wonderful world-class players. Yeah. But again, they had the individual quality, the individual brilliance, but we had something which is very difficult to play against, and that's the togetherness again, and the idea that if we could shock them early on, then, and that was something we talked about before the game, Richard Mullins and said in the team talk and said, let's go out, let's attack them, because they think you will defend and defend. But let's go out and attack them. If we can get a goal within the first 5 or 6 minutes, 10 minutes, then they will start to feel the pressure. Perhaps even the fans will turn against them. And in some respects, that was exactly what happened. Mm. We got that first goal, and that unsettled a world-class side.
Mm. So suddenly now things are getting serious. You're into the final, and you go from the Euro 88 champions to the reigning world champions in Germany. So this is your chance. It's in Gothenburg. 37 days beforehand, you weren't even in the tournament, and now suddenly you're in the final. Were you starting, can you remember, Brian, to get a sense of how big a story this was becoming in Denmark, or were communications such that you didn't really know?
We didn't have social media back then, so it was all about, despite being just across from Denmark in Sweden, we didn't really realize how big a deal it was back home. Until we got the newspapers sent over, and we could see, you know, thousands of people on Danish in Copenhagen streets and enjoying themselves and watching the games, giant screens, and it was incredible. And you have to understand one thing, that when we played against England, only 2,500 Danish fans went across to watch it, so we weren't popular. Uh-huh. I mean, who are not like the team that they are celebrating right now? So, in that respect, we were up against world class opponents, but we were up against our own fans as well to start with.
Wow!
And that changed completely when we beat the French, and from there on, you know, we were the darlings of the nation, and that changed the thought about this team completely. And change our lives as well.
Am I right in saying your old club teammate Stefan Effenberg phoned you the eve of the match?
He did. And you know what he said? He said, Brian, absolutely fantastic. We're good friends. We're playing at Bayern Munich. I want to swap shirts tomorrow night. Is that okay with you? And I said, definitely. I mean, it's going to be fantastic. You're absolutely your favorites. And we are knackered, you know. So we'll do that, no doubt about it. It's an honor playing against Germany. It's an honor playing against you. And I hope it will be a fantastic game to watch. And hopefully we could make a wee surprise. And then we played the final. Again, as I say, got the first goal, which shocked the Germans. And I have to say, I've watched the game on a number of occasions since then. And every time I watch it, I think, oh, my God, Denmark are going to be hammered, you know. We were attacked from all angles, left-hand side, right-hand side, up front, great attacking players. But Peter Schmeichel, he was in that game outstanding. One of the best performances I've ever seen Peter play, actually. And he was the difference between the two teams. But we got the goal from Judd Jensen. He never scores normally, but he got the goal. And we got the second one, which obviously sealed the win. And after the game, I was just, you know, I was watching, looking for Stefan Effenberg. Where is he? We have to swap shirts. And he had always left the pitch, you know, and he never got it. So it just showed you that, I mean, they were in such belief that they would beat us, you know, comfortably. Mm. So he never thought about the idea of losing. And I think it just shows you being an underdog from a small country, whether it's Ireland, whether it's Scotland, Denmark, you can produce a miracle sometimes. And we certainly did that.
Brian, it seems as well like on the injury front in advance of that final that your team hotel was akin to an accident and emergency waiting room. It seemed like you were just bashed up as a team. How bad was it? How many walking wounded were there?
It was bad. I mean, really bad. At some point, we were really struggling. I think it was about 24 hours before the game, Richard Miller-Nielsen, he sat down with the players and say, I mean, how are you? Do you think you could play in about 24 hours, playing the biggest final of your career, perhaps the only one you will ever get to? And at that point, I think a lot of players, they said yes, but they meant no, because we were really struggling with heavy injuries. I mean, we are talking muscle injuries, we're talking hip injuries. I was still coming to terms with my knee injury. So at that point, a day before the game, to get 11 fit players, that would be a miracle. Mm. But something changed in the night. And next day, and I have to say, some of the players that lined up in that final from the beginning, they weren't fit. Mm. Definitely not. Mm. John Sieverbeck is the best example. He had a huge muscle problem. And you know what? He was one of the fastest fullbacks I've ever seen. His game was all about pace. And can you imagine not being able to run, really? So he had to change his game completely. And we had a fantastic scenario before the game. We had Kent Nielsen, who played in central defense. You can say a lot of good things about Kent Nielsen, but we were certainly not quick. And he was up against the likes of John Sieverbeck, who was perhaps one of the quickest players I've played with. And on the eve before the game, we were all, after the final training session, Richard Miller-Nielsen gathered all the players and he says, if I have to choose tomorrow, I have to have a running session with John Sieverbeck and Kent Nielsen. Over three runs, who's the fastest? Can you imagine being Kent Nielsen? Mm. Slow, strong in the air, very good, you know, fantastic defender, but not quick against perhaps one of the quickest players in Europe at that time. Mm. So they do their running course, you know, and Kent Nielsen loses all three of these speed tests. And the players turn around, and Kent Nielsen, he was in tears because he knew that if that was going to be vital for Richard Miller-Nielsen, he wouldn't play the next day. So Richard Miller-Nielsen, he says, I've seen you have done everything in your power, both of you. And I said, if I have to choose, but I do not have to choose, you're both playing tomorrow in the final. And that was, psychologically, it was genius, because these two players, they went out there, perhaps not being completely fit 100%, but they left everything on that pitch.
Yes.
And on the day, it was enough.
There are so many extraordinary stories, I suppose, dotted all over this team. And so you mentioned John Jensen scoring the opening goal. I might come back to him in a second. Great character. Arsenal fans remember him. The second goal, which is crucial because it's 1-0 and Germany are really hammering at the goal and Peter Schmeichel's making a lot of great saves. And you suspect if Germany had equalised, it would have been big trouble for Denmark. So the second goal is very important. And it's Kim Vilfort, Brøndby legend. He was Danish player of the year in 1991, attacking midfielder. He scores the second goal, and if you were making a movie about these kind of things, you couldn't make this stuff up. And indeed, there is a movie on Netflix if people want to watch it, and Kim Vilfort's story is to the fore in that movie. So, in effect, Brian, for people who don't know, and I'm curious to get your memories of how Kim handled this tournament. Kim had a daughter who was 7 years of age and who was battling cancer, and at the start of the tournament, it seemed like she was responding to treatment. And then before the French game, it turns out she's no longer responding to treatment and her outlook is very bleak. And he rushes home. He misses that French game. Family persuade him to come back for the Dutch game. Then he goes home again. And ultimately, she's very poorly. And ultimately, it's a very sad ending for her. She doesn't manage to survive cancer. She seems to convince him, Line is her name, to go back for the final. And he scores this second goal. It's just remarkable and both so sad and emotional. And your memory of that Vilfort situation through the tournament and for him to score the second goal, I mean, it's just extraordinary. You were all aware, I'm sure, of what he was going through at the time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's in both ways, it's a tragic story and it's a yeah, there's something you could learn from that story as well. I think you have to understand that Kim Vilfort was a very generous guy, right. Generous in the way he played. He was a typical team player who left everything on the pitch, who was as good offensively, defensively. He was the old days, you know, you would say box to box midfield player. A former striker, actually. So he knew where the goal was. And as you say correctly, during the Euro 92, he had to leave camp, went back home. At that point, we were not sure whether we were going to see him again in that competition. And a few days later, he came back and he played the final. And you have to say that it was so fitting for the whole feeling in the camp that he was going to score the winner, because it was very sad, obviously, the background for him leaving, but in another way it was comforting that it was actually his daughter who persuaded him to go back and play the final. So she wanted him to finish off what he had started, and I think that was a beautiful moment in a very difficult one as well. And it was fitting, as I say, that he got the second goal, which completely made the difference. And that was the moment where we knew we have produced a miracle here in football terms.
I think it makes it, therefore, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, goals scored in the final for all those reasons. You know, it's just such a powerful moment for him, and terribly sad one, I'm sure, in retrospect. And also, I mean, his daughter got to see him, you know, do that, which must be a kind of a source of comfort as well. How did he cope? How does someone manage to function with all that going on? I wonder. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's a very tough question. I think we all know that you can hide a lot of emotions behind the mask, and I think that was exactly what he did. But he hit it well. Mm. And I think he was the kind of guy who didn't leave too much in open space. I mean, he was definitely not introvert, but he was somebody who kept his feelings for himself. But again, generous in the way he handled the pressure, in the way he played, and the way he was in camp. So it was the right guy to make the difference, and certainly that moment for me stands out in that competition. I think no matter how you see things, that he would get the final goal. That was good.
Yeah, extraordinary. So Jean Jensen scored the opener. Now, if ever a man picked a moment to deliver, it was Jean Jensen. Look, he has a reputation, and apparently Muller Nielsen was saying to him all tournament, just look at your boots, nowhere else, just look down at your boots when you're striking the ball. So, look, he would not be renowned as an amazing ball striker, I think it's fair to say, and yet, I mean, the goal was amazing. So, were you all as surprised as anyone?
Yeah, you should know that Mirta Molnilsson said that to John Jensen for a lot of years, you know, look at your boots, and that didn't help.
So, okay.
And during the warm-up, he tried exactly the same shot, you know, and I think he hit a fan in the stands or something.
Okay.
Somewhere, you know, I mean, he scored a few goals, John, and I have to say that he was a very important member of our midfield. He would run all day. He was a good pass off the ball, a little bit underrated at times, I think. I think the Arsenal fans would perhaps they thought that he would score more goals than he did. But having said that, it came out of the blue that he would score the first one, because that just showed me that we were going to win it. Because if that happens, that happens once in a decade. But he's a wonderful guy, John. He was a real character on and off the park, and certainly one who kept our emotions high. And he was a well-tempered guy as well. He would go into all sorts of tackles, but he was important.
And so just like that, the miracle has happened, and it's just extraordinary, and I think the whole world was cheering on Denmark. I've since watched the homecoming, and the scenes are extraordinary as well, and the Denmark team there in their very bright green shirts are in amongst in amongst it all. Your memories of that?
Definitely. I think it was quite clear to everybody that that we were quite late into this competition, because they couldn't really, you know, we couldn't get any suits fitted, you know, for us. So the only thing they had was these Hummel short sleeve shirts in green. I mean, they were ugly, but but having said that, I mean, that was the story as well, wasn't it? I mean, we came over that late that we looked terrible. some people even think that we played terribly as well, but we got the job done, yeah. and got the trophy. And I think the story is not that simple, because we played some good stuff as well within the possibilities that we had in terms of preparing for it. But we have to remember, nowadays they have got 24 teams playing in the Euro. And back then it was 8 teams, but with the likes of the reigning world champions, the reigning European champions, with England and France as well, there were some very good teams in there. So yes. I think we deserved it.
You did it. No, you did for sure. You did it the hard way. Brian, I was very curious to get the sense now of Richard Møller-Nielsen, because initially, as I said, he didn't get the job with any great fanfare, and there was the initial difficulties, and the style of football wasn't what the Danes had really enjoyed in the 1980s. And just looking at some of the coverage, even during 92, some of the TV pundits are saying, well, look, the players, they're not listening to Møller-Nielsen. It's not really about him. Has he been given the credit that he deserves amongst the Danish footballing fraternity?
I think nowadays the perception of Richard Møller-Nielsen has changed completely. I think he was perhaps misunderstood in a number of ways. I think the problem, again, being assistant of Sepp Piontek, who was perhaps one of the most loved coaches we have had in Danish football history. He joined after that, you know, the great 84-86 team. So he it was difficult for him to start with. But having said that, I think he produced the goods. We won the Confederations Cup. Back then it was the King Fat Cup in 95 as well. 96 was not that successful, but realizing that we are a small country with 5.5 million people, I mean, he put us on the map, on the football map. I think he showed that even small countries can win and perform. And I salute him. I think the perception of it was always defensive-minded football. Yes, it was perhaps, he looked very much in, he was a very pragmatic kind of manager, but I have to say he delivered the goods. And for that, he's still loved in this country.
Yes, I'm sure. How difficult was it for your brother to watch on?
He phoned me on the eve before the final, actually. He was in America on holiday. And but, you know, he said, what is going on? I mean, this is crazy. Stuff. But as I say again, you know, yeah, we'll lose the final, Michael. You can keep your Champions League medal. You know, he won that year with Barcelona against Sampdoria. So I didn't really believe it, you know, on the eve before the game. But after that, you know, we had a good conversation. We saw each other that summer, and we enjoyed it and say, okay, it's been a great summer for this family. You winning the Champions League, we've won the Euros. I mean, this is going to be very difficult to top that one, and we were very proud. It was a great moment of in 92 for both of us.
Yes, I can imagine. I guess that's the way to look at it. I'm sure he wouldn't be human if he didn't think to himself, damn.
He never said that, but okay. I think inside, you know, deep inside him, I think it must be strange to watch your country winning such a famous victory, such a unique summer it was, and not being part of it. But he chose it himself, so in that respect, I don't see any regrets. But deep inside, I think he would have loved to be there.
What effect do you think this had on your life?
I remember Prem Elkiah, he was commentating that that day, and I've heard the commentary since then, and what he says after the final whistle was, this victory is going to change the lives of every single one of these players. And back then, I didn't really realize what it meant, really, because it's such a difficult feeling to take in and to understand what you have achieved. Well, I think for a number of players, myself included, it made it possible to go to other countries playing for some great teams. Even nowadays, you know, we're sitting talking about 92 here, 29 years on. It's something that will follow me and the players for the rest of our lives. I still meet people in the streets. It could be an American or an Indian, and they will say, "Ah, I remember what I did back in 92. It was fantastic to watch." And that's something. This is what football gives you, and it's sensational.
Yeah, amazing. A last one. I hope life is good now. You still look great. I had no idea, by the way. I just saw late last year, I think you posted on social media that you'd been given the all clear from cancer after a long 10-year battle of treatment and checkups. I didn't realize you'd been going through all that. So congratulations on getting the all clear. That must be a tough road, 10 years.
It was a tough road. In some respects, sometimes it's, you know, time is flying by. I mean, 10 years since I got the diagnosis, it seemed like it was a few years back. But having said that, I think I've been very fortunate living in this era. I am, you know, with the treatments they have got nowadays. I was very fortunate. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that I will keep it that way, but I'm very thankful and that I can sit here and talk to you. It's always when you get a diagnosis like that, you start to think about life. It puts your life in perspective. But having got the all clear, I hope it will continue like that and just enjoy myself every day.
Great. Well, listen, we hope for the same. It's been such a pleasure to listen to you talk about this extraordinary story once again. I'm sure you've done it a million times in your life, but it was great for us to hear some of the stories. Brian Laudrup, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
The story of the UEFA European Championships on OTB Sports with Heineken, official beer partner of UEFA Euro 2020. Finally together to be rivals again. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.